Good afternoon. We're going to begin the Ag Policy Committee this afternoon, and we're going to start with a bill that we've all been waiting for, I believe. House File 2315, which is Representative Kahn, is bringing forth the Industrial Hemp Bill. And she is coming to the table.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman. I know you'll be pleased to know that I resisted the section that I come in, and I have this small technical amendment where we would just add the medical marijuana bill onto it. So I decided, even if I kind of agreed with it and the philosophy, it probably wasn't a good idea. So
it's good to have a clean bill. Yes, Representative Hamilton.
You know, I think I recall Representative Kahn, one year, I think, you brought us brownies when we were here.
I know. And next time, and I was thinking about that last night, but getting home at 11:30 was just not a possibility. And which reminds me,
sorry, Madam Chair.
Oh, yeah. No, so now you've taken her from the table. She's left the table. So
I did think about it, but 11:30 last night was not a possibility. And I just do want to. I do have. Sorry, it's not brownies. And I'll talk about those later. Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm getting a little organized. As many of you know, particularly former Chair Hamilton, I've worked on this issue for many years. We've had stronger bills before the legislature. I think they're still in my cabinet if they haven't been introduced. But stronger bills with violation sections, rules sections, penalties. They've usually passed this committee almost unanimously and then met death at the hands of the law enforcement negativity, which, although uninformed, was remarkably effective. The form of this bill, although much wimpier than others that have been enacted, should meet one of law enforcement's objections, which is the conflict with the feds. Because what we have done in this bill is we have just taken the bill, thanks to our excellent researcher, Mr. Sullivan, just totally takes the language out of the Federal Farm Bill and just incorporates the language that was in the Federal Farm Bill into state law. So although it doesn't go as far as I would like to go and as far as some other states would go, I think it's a start in the atmosphere that we've had to move in on this subject. So I do have at least a foot of information up in my office if any of you need further information than what I've given you. But let me just highlight what I have given you. And I'll talk in some more detail about all of them. In the packet that you have with this bill is a letter from Dr. Wieblin, who's a professor of plant biology at the University of Minnesota on the St. Paul campus. He's unfortunately, or fortunately for him, I guess, spending a sabbatical in Australia, so I've only been able to talk to him by mail. So his testimony is in the form of a letter that you have. I'll also, the next piece in your set of material is a letter and a pamphlet from Representative David Monson, who's the Speaker of the House of the North Dakota Legislature. He's been a leader on this in the country. I always said if I could have morphed myself into his profile, I could have gotten the bill passed right away. He's a Republican, he's a Speaker of the House, a minister, he's a farmer, and he farms right next to the Canadian border. And one of the things that motivated him was looking at what he was getting per acre for barley and the problems he was having, environmental problems in a wet year, which is apparently bad for barley, and looking just across the border to his neighbor who was reaping at least many times more the profit growing industrial hemp, some of the products of which then get shipped into the United States. So that's The next thing I have in there, I hope I have the same order that you do, but they're all in it, is an article called Back to Chernobyl, which is how, and again, now we should be thinking about Chernobyl since it's in the Ukraine, but hemp helped clean the soil around Chernobyl. And one of the things that we've been talking about is hemp as an environmental cleanser. Then we talked to what's been happening recently. So there's a New York Times article about the groundwork laid and the growers turned to hemp in Colorado. Is that hemp, and that part of what's happening is that when the federal government said it wasn't going to go after marijuana, even though federal DEA law still prohibited it, said they weren't going after marijuana in states that had legalized marijuana, it was also decided that the states that had legalized hemp, of which there are many more, 10 or 11 of them, can turn and grow that. One of my favorite ones, because it puts me in alliance with someone that I've hardly ever been alliance with, is Kentucky hemp can move ahead under justice ruling, state agriculture commissioner says. The huge pressure was put on the Kentucky legislature and the government in Kentucky by our good friend in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, who decided that this was something that Kentucky really needed to do and they really needed to move ahead on it. The final thing that I have in the packet is the world's oldest fabric is now its newest. This was an older article. I don't know if I have the date on it. Yeah, 95. Date on it from the New York Times, which talks about the many uses that we're seeing of hemp. And remember, whenever you see a hemp product with the made in USA sense that we've often had, you know, I miss Representative Rukavina to be making this speech, but all of the hemp that it's made with has had to be imported. And Minnesota Fabrics, a farmers, could be growing this. I did bring two props. I've had one is, and I do apologize, it was remembered, when I did make brownies, they were only dusted with hemp seed. They did not have any illegal substances in it. And I have to not, we have to not schedule the bill after an 11, after a committee that ends at, Representative Wiginius's committee, which ended at 11:30 or something. No, GovOp, sorry. GovOp that ended at 11:30, so my apologies. But anyway, here is hemp seed. It's a company called Manitoba Harvest. And it was it was 8 ounces. I've managed to misplace the price. I think the price of this was about $9. And at the same time, I also had same weight of sunflower seeds, which I think was 225, something like that. So plus the fact that hemp requires much less inputs and it's much cheaper to grow than sunflower seeds. Here is a very nice, which I can. I can pass both of these around. This is a hand crochet.
He can help you there. Because we'll need to.
You can taste the seeds. If you right. But they're not as good. They're better when I put them on brownies. And the. So again, it's just talking about the uses of it.
Thank you.
I do have. Again, since it's the latest piece, I'd like to pay attention to Dr. Wiebelin's letter and one of the things. And then one of the things, although we've made strong economic arguments for hemp in the past, one of the things that's emerging, and I guess I showed that with the Chernobyl letter, one of the things that's emerging is also the environmental reasons for growing hemp. It's in the quest for more sustainable crops, many see hemp as a no-brainer. Its cultivation does not need any particular climate or soil, and I'll remind people that Minnesota during the war was a primary source of hemp for the armed services. It's a dense plant, so sunlight cannot penetrate the leaves to reach the ground, so it's free of weeds. It's naturally resistant to pests, so growing it doesn't require pesticides or herbicides. It can be harvested just 120 days after planting, and it's so leafy that it produces more oxygen than other crops. It could replace trees as the main source of raw material for wood and paper, thereby preserving forests. Fabrics made of hemp don't have any chemical residue, making them safer for consumers and the environment, and they can be recycled, reused, and are 100% biodegradable. So one of the things that this was from an article in Governing this past October, and again it points out that unless Congress passes a bill authorizing it, it's you can't legally do it in the states. Representative Speaker Munson, whom I tried to get a hold of and haven't been able to do, North Dakota really doesn't meet at all this year, and the last North Dakota representative I talked to was spending this winter in Florida, so I don't know where Mr. Munson is, but at any rate, he and another a farmer who have licenses from North Dakota, which went much further than we did to grow hemp, were suing the Justice Department in court to try and get their licenses upheld. And I just don't know what's happened in this. Many years ago with a legislator from Hawaii, whom I met at a legislative conference, Representative Cynthia Thielen and I wrote an article that was in one of the CSG journals, and we worked together on this issue. And even though these other states have gone by us, North Dakota, Kentucky, Tennessee, etc., she also this year is introducing the same bill. So I think I do have some people to testify, and I'd like to bring them up. I don't know.
That would be great.
So I'd like to bring up the people from the farm organizations first.
Tom Peterson, Ken Peterson, Doug Musselman, who are listed on the agenda here. So as you come forward, state your name for the record, please, okay. And we'll give you a testimony. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and we strongly support House File 2315, and MFU has long had a policy, has been supportive of hemp and worked with Representative Kahn for a long time. I know my first year, so it's been 12 years, and I was looking for my testimony because I've probably given it, for 12 years off and on every other year. I'm not going to tell you all the great things that hemp, I think most of the committee knows that, and I just encourage you to look at that. What's changed is the federal farm bill, which is a nice surprise. It was one of the last things that we kind of found out that was going to be in there, had this authorizing language for states that had already passed it, which is about 10 states. Tennessee, too, just I think yesterday passed hemp-enabling legislation. And so it's really interesting to see. Over the years, I'd work a lot harder on this bill, and I'd call farmers in Canada that were actually doing it, because I was kind of interested in the nuts and bolts of this. Would farmers, because we've always had farmers interested in this, but I always wondered, would they do this, and would they plant and harvest it? And the farmers that I talked to, they would say they're really excited about it and they like it, but it's a difficult crop to the harvest is the hardest part. Planting, as Representative Kahn said, doesn't need a lot of inputs or anything, but depends on if you're harvesting it for the seed or the fiber. The seed's a lot easier, and it's gotten easier with combines improving, but the process of using the fiber for biofuels could be for our next legislation you're going to hear, or bedding. In England, uses it for bedding, and so it's a really interesting issue. China's the lead producer, I thought, which is interesting, and in hemp. And I always say that it's interesting, we can buy all the products, they grow it and they sell it to us, we buy their products, but we can't grow it and buy it here. I said, so we're just helping out their agriculture, and something else we could do. Canada is the country I look at the most, and I wondered how many acres or what would we do. I think Canada, if I'm right, the most they ever planted was about 50,000 acres. They've done that twice. But even in the last few years, the farmers would say because of rotations and demand, they planted as little as 6,000 acres 5 years ago. So 50,000 acres, I looked it up last night. If you look at like Maurer County plants 200,000 acres of corn, even if we did 50,000 acres, it's not going to be widespread. It would be kind of a niche type thing. Also in Canada, it's kind of integrated. So you don't just go and grow, you know, you got to have a market for it. So you see companies contracting with farmers, and then it's almost like a co-op type model where the farmers are in a co-op and then they're selling it to, with that company and growing it. So that's, I think a couple of interesting points, and just urge your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, when Representative Wagenius started raising all the issues about pollinators, I jumped on that. Maybe this would be a terrific pollinator. It turns if I went to my, I should have just said it, but instead I went to my experts who said, no, it's wind pollinated, not bee pollinated. So I can't make that argument.
Okay. All right. We have Ken Peterson and Doug. Yes, Representative Petersburg, you had a question?
Not so much a question, it's just a comment as well. Many years ago, I was going through some of my dad's things as going through it, and I came across a brochure printed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture teaching the farmers how to raise hemp back then. And when asked, I found out that actually south of Owatonna somewhere in Blooming Prairie area or something, there actually was a hemp processing plant. And of course, it was primarily hemp at that time was used for rope a lot, and it was really the war effort of World War I and others that actually promoted it. So it is nothing new in southern Minnesota to raise hemp. It just hasn't been there for almost 100 years.
Mm-hmm. So. Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Actually, it's Mr. Anderson. But
Mr. Anderson. Okay, I'm sorry.
That's right. My name is Ken Anderson, and I am the principal of multiple hemp-based businesses. My first hemp business is Original Green Distribution, which we started in 2009. And what we do with that is we import hemp-based building products. And as you know, that is one of the barriers to entry of the market is the import cost and us supporting other farmers and other processors in other countries. We can bring a lot of our costs down if we can produce domestically. And with the federal farm bill, there is some movement here. My team has been asked to run a pilot project from Commissioner Comer in the state of Kentucky, which we are doing under the direction of the Department of Agriculture. And what we are doing there is my company owns 13 European cultivars of industrial hemp that have been shown to be viable for the American market. And so what we're doing there is we are research and developing the yields based upon those cultivars from Italy and Europe to see what they will produce here in America. And if we have a passage of a bill like what's on the floor now, the HF 3515, I believe it is. 2315, sorry about that. We then will be able to do in Minnesota what we are already doing in the state of Kentucky. Kentucky is going to be very beneficial as far as producing the seed for us to grow here in the northern states because of the photocycles. We will produce 30% higher fiber yields than Kentucky will with the same cultivars planted in Minnesota. Wisconsin actually had a viable hemp industry until 1955, which most people are not aware of. Our current focus, though, we can import all the products we need to. That is true. We can import any portion of the plant unless it's a live hemp seed. But some of the barriers that we have with importation costs are some of the markets that aren't developed that hemp can be very beneficial to. One of them would be is going to be discussed later on in this very room, and that is a biofuel. Cellulose-based biofuels are the new up-and-coming, it'll fill the gap between ethanol and petroleum-based fuels. And this is something that's very exciting, and I have a major corporate partner in research and development of hemp for cellulose-based feedstocks. So I guess I am just asking for consideration of this bill here to be able to do in Minnesota what we will be doing in Kentucky. With the passage of the Federal Farm Bill, with a bill like this, which is a very good first step, it is a simple first step. I don't want to start the argument, but we will be able to break the conflation and show that hemp is not pot. Hemp is a jobs bill and an industry bill. We cannot produce drugs from hemp, and we have no intentions to do anything of the such. I think if you talk with the average American farmer, they have no interest in that crop. This is an agricultural crop that we just want to be able to bless the state of Minnesota with building the industry. So I thank you for your time.
And thank you, Mr. Anderson. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Anderson, or maybe this is for Representative Kahn, you know, I've supported this year after year after year, and you read all the information that you sent out that, you know, this has no value as a narcotic. You know, every one of these talks about that. So help us understand where the roadblock is. Is the fear, since it looks as such as, you know, as you know, a marijuana plant or whatever, is there fear, or how real is it to be able to plant this side by side when it pollinates through the air and whatever else? Can you speak to that, what the argument is?
This is actually covered pretty well in Dr. Wiebland's letter, because he was often here testifying before it. And I don't know if we've got any law enforcement people today. They would... I don't even remember if they came to the Agriculture Committee, but they would always just, it would go to Representative Cornish's committee, and that was the end of it. But the one of the things that most of the arguments that they gave were flawed. For one thing, the first argument they would give is, let me deal with the one you raised, is that the growing one. The growing one just fails on biological grounds, because apparently if you grow the two crops side by side, first of all, the argument that people would use the system we have to hide growing the real stuff, or the bad stuff, whatever you want to call it, or the good stuff in this. First of all, since the first thing you had to do was give geophysical, you know, identifications when you got your license. Most people who are going to do an illegal act don't like to tell you exactly the exact place you're going to be doing it. The next thing was that, so that was first the practical reason. Next thing was also the biological reason. Apparently you grow the two crops, the two things together, they cross-pollinate, and it's ruined for both of them. So it was, so both of them were just wrong, but we never got to pursue it further because the Ag Committee didn't believe them, and the Criminal Justice Committee never heard them. So we never, but Dr. Wiebland goes through those arguments. And one of the things he was working on, and maybe it won't be necessary, he's worked very hard at developing the low, discernibly low THC, whatever the word is, varieties of cannabis. And he, one of the things he was trying to work on, maybe he won't have to do that now, he was trying to work on one that would really get genetically a species that would really be physically discernible, like red or yellow instead of green or something like that. And I don't know how far he went with that, but it would be awfully nice if he didn't have to, because that sounds like if the plant wanted to be that color, it would have evolved to do it, and it seems that
would have. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a follow-up, you know, going down that biological argument, you'd almost think that they'd want to support it, because if this was out there in a number of fields, that you'd have that cross-pollination that would, in essence, ruin the illegal crop.
Mr. Anderson.
Okay. Thompson.
There's empirical data that supports what you just said going on in Colorado right now. Because one of the things that they're having with, I have no interest in the medical marijuana field whatsoever. I am for the agricultural crop. I do acknowledge a few of the problems that they're having, though, because of last year them planting industrial hemp in a few different plots. And the cross-pollination, even in indoor grow operations, ruined millions of dollars worth of crops. And another thing that I'd like to say is that there's 33 other countries in this world that don't have legalized marijuana that do grow industrial hemp. They do not have a single one of the problems that are touted by the opposition to this. There are so many reasons that the conflation, to prove that the conflation is false. Some of the plants that we grow 14 feet tall in 13 weeks. That right there is going to, the canopy on that would not allow a marijuana, let alone any other plant, grow underneath it. That's why we don't need the herbicides and the such, because of the canopy on those plants. Cross-pollination will always work towards the negative, and anyone that would know anything about marijuana cultivation doesn't want an industrial hemp crop anywhere near it, because it would be the last place you'd want to hide it. We have hundreds of thousands of acres of corn that if you wanted to grow marijuana, that'd probably be a better place to do it. They're not going to want to be anywhere near hemp. They're very easy to differentiate. There is no, the conflation is not based upon fact. Any type of argument that would come up against, if anyone would want to debate that, I welcome it, and I will bring science to the table, and let's have at it, because I'm a little tired of fighting antiquated laws that are hampering my industry, and it's time we move forward. The feds are moving forward. I say, let's do it.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, if I can just say one.
Yes, quickly, and then I'm bringing Mr. Yes. Busselman down as well.
Yes. Just one comment is that the Canadian Royal Mounted Police were totally opposed to it, and now once it was legalized, they have admitted that it has made their job much easier. And, oh, they actually even dropped the THC, Mr. Thompson informs me, they've dropped that testing in Canada this year because there's no need. There's no, you don't need to any time. This stuff is being grown, the other stuff doesn't, so you never have to test it.
Thank you. Mr. Busselman, I'll bring you to the table.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Welcome.
Chair Poppe, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Busselman. I am the Director of Public Policy for Minnesota Farm Bureau, and I would like to speak in support of passage of 2315. This bill deals with research of industrial hemp. We have policy that supports research of industrial hemp, and that's why we're here supporting this bill.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? So anyone from the audience that would like to speak on behalf or in opposition to this bill? Otherwise, Representative Falk, I see you were on House File 2315. I do have one question, Representative Kahn, before we move the bill. On line 1.16, it says the commissioner may authorize institutions of higher education to grow or cultivate industrial hemp. What exactly are you thinking there? What does that mean?
Well, I think it would be through an we took the language exactly from the federal bill. We didn't want to change one paragraph, one period. I don't know what Mr. Sullivan did to do it. And what I think that means is that means that it's under the auspices of an institution of higher education, apparently. And so it doesn't necessarily have to be on their grounds or anything like that. But it would be. It's not. We're not going to open an application process up to every possible farmer who wants to come try it out. As I said, I have in my desk and actually introduced, they have bills that go very much further than this. But we thought we'd get rid of one set of arguments.
All right, thank you. Well, Representative Falk is on the bill, so he's going to move this bill to government operations. Right?
I don't know. We thought it's never been to government. It just had to go to the floor.
You have rulemaking in here.
Oh, okay. Right.
So I think it has to go to government operations.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Conn and I both serve on government operations, so we can both take a look at it there. But being that seems to be the appropriate motion, I'd move that House File 2315 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
All right. We'll now bringing up House File 2456. Representative Poppy, would you like to move your bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We do have House File 2456. We'll have a few testifiers on behalf of this bill. And I just wanted to talk about, this is really a next generation bioeconomy bill. We are, you know, we just heard from industrial hemp about industrial hemp and trying to increase the possibilities for agriculture and other economic supportive kinds of things in our state, and this would do likewise. This would be a bill that will begin the opportunity for businesses to come to our state, to actually grow in our state, and to develop in the bioeconomy area. And so I will turn it over to some testifiers to begin with. Just in the interest of time, we'll just kind of move this along.
Yeah, great. So on your agenda, it says Brendan Jordan with the Great Plains Institute. I'm not Brendan. My name is Amanda Billick. I also work at the Great Plains Institute, and I'm here testifying in support of 2456. The Great Plains Institute.
You know what? I'm sorry. We do have an amendment, though, so I will move the amendment.
All right. Let's do that first.
Which is the 2456 DE2. It should be in people's packets, but we do want to move that amendment.
Do you want to explain briefly what that does compared to what we've got?
She'll actually be speaking to the amended bill. So
Okay, but so you want to just pass it and then we'll discuss it? Is that how you want to handle it?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. All those in favor of the DE2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. So we now are on the amended version of the bill.
Okay.
So Amanda Billick, is that right?
Yes.
All right. Please state your name again for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Amanda Billick, Great Plains Institute, and we also represent the Bioeconomy Coalition of Minnesota. This is a multi-stakeholder group that includes industry, environmental community, agriculture, forestry, and entrepreneurial startup companies. A full list of coalition members can be found in the packet that's going around of some slides that I'm just going to talk from, and those coalition partners are listed on page 2. And the coalition's mission is to help grow bio-based industries in Minnesota. So Minnesota has all the ingredients for growing a renewable chemicals and advanced biofuels industry. We have abundant agricultural, forestry, and organic waste feedstocks that could be converted into higher value products. Minnesota led the world in creating a first-generation ethanol industry. We have a strong historic forest products industry, but the harvest is currently in decline due to changing market conditions. We also have a world-leading cluster of renewable chemical companies. In the past 5 years, these companies have brought more than $200 million in venture capital investment into Minnesota and have applied for over 200 patents. They're working on replacing materials and products that are now made from petroleum, and these can include products such as plastics, fabrics, household cleaners, and paints. This program is currently modeled after the successful ethanol producer payment program that helped create an ethanol industry that now contributes over $5 million annually to Minnesota's economy. Minnesota has the opportunity to move beyond some of the lab coat jobs that are currently in the Twin Cities and scale up production of advanced biofuels and renewable chemicals in greater Minnesota. The bill you have before you would enable that expansion. The production incentive approach rewards success. The state doesn't pay until a facility is up and running. There's no risk of giving large grants and getting no project. The program would help Minnesota compete with other states that have already lured Minnesota companies away. And it helps first-of-a-kind technology, clean technology projects get financed and commercialized. Great Plains Institute has been working with the University of Minnesota, and we have conducted an input-output analysis to determine how large of an economic impact this policy would have and what the return on investment would be for Minnesota. We collected data from real companies under a confidentiality agreement regarding some real proposed projects. The University of Minnesota calculated an economic impact if those projects were deployed in Minnesota. We estimate that scaling up the industry over the next 15 years would cost the state on average between $9 to $23 million annually over 15 years, and then no more payments after that. For the investment, what the state would get in permanent is 14 new facilities that are producing advanced biofuels and renewable chemicals, about $870 million in annual economic output, and 3,000 new permanent jobs. More detail on the economic study can also be found in your handout starting on page 3. As far as construction impacts, there would be 1,500 million in one-time construction output, and about 8,000 one-time construction jobs. We also ran a mature ethanol scenario, a mature industry scenario, and if every ethanol plant added some cellulosic ethanol capacity, and what if timber harvest was returned to historic levels, the state would reach an initial investment tipping point, and the commercial technology would take off on its own. So in concluding, we think this is a very rare opportunity for economic growth in agriculture, forestry, and in the metro area. So we ask for your support in helping to build this new industry. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony, Mrs. Billick. Do we have any questions? No? All right. Thank you again very much. You must have done good since there were no questions. The next testifier. I have down Dale Colesrud.
Thank you, okay. Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Please state your name and proceed with. Well, I have a question from Representative Hamilton.
No, Mr. Chair. Once we get through the testifiers, or maybe before, if we could just have a brief description of the bill itself.
Okay. We'll get there. Okay. Thank you. Let's.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is. Are you going into the bill now?
Yes, go ahead. State your name and proceed with your testimony.
Well, it's David Colesrud, not Dale Colesrud, as it's listed. And
very good.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm here to testify in favor of House File 2456, Renewable Chemical and Advanced Biofuels. Well, why am I here? Well, I started back in 1995 in the fuel ethanol industry, worked 2.5 years to put together a co-op. We built a nice ethanol facility in Laverne, Minnesota. It did everything it was supposed to do for the farmers in the community. And we sold it to a company called Gevo back in 2010. Gevo is one of the most advanced biochemical companies on the planet today. It's owned by a bunch of venture capitalists, and by our relationship with working with the farmers and with the company, we've been able to see a window to the future and seeing how valuable these renewable chemicals are and some of these advanced biofuels. Some of the products that are currently being produced can be transformed into almost anything that petroleum is making, but it comes from a renewable source. The only way you can tell the difference is by carbon dating them. One goes back a million years and one goes back 3 years. These products are currently grown in Minnesota. They're raised in Minnesota. They're being processed in Minnesota. And we're using educated kids out of the University of Minnesota to help develop this, and we're just beginning. And through my travels, I get to see all kinds of companies that are looking to do the same thing, and they're looking at Minnesota for a lot of reasons. One of them is you have a broad-based line of feedstocks from the north to the south. You have everything from forest products to some of the marginal land that can grow energy crops to traditional corn fields and bean fields. So it's a wide variety of products. I think when I look at where we've been and where we're going, 10 years from now, Minnesota could be right smack dab in the middle of this with not just one company, but many, many companies, thanks to the university, thanks to the legislature, thanks to everybody here. One thing that I've learned over the years when we do projects, there's three key things to making a successful industry. It takes vision, cooperation, and commitment. One thing is with vision, it's not just one person's vision, it's everybody working together, whether it's the legislature or the academia or the research scientists or the farmers or the feedstock. We all need to be a part of the vision. If we all are part of the vision, we'll make it work, we'll all cooperate, and then we'll be successful in the long term. So that's just my window of the future.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Colesrud. Do we have any questions for him? Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've had this discussion in the past. Can you just address the whole collection, handling, and transferring of the Stover? That's been an issue in the past as far as, not an issue, but just a question. How does that happen? We have a little bit of data or history behind us now. Can you just speak to that, please?
Okay, Representative Hamilton. Thank you for the question. I am a farmer, so when you start talking about collection of Stover you know, and I'm not, I think your questions aim pretty much at Stover, but when we start talking about collection for renewable biomass projects, it could be forest products, and another one that's really big is municipal solid waste. But when we get into the silver, and I do farm, and I'm part of all of the sustainable roundtable where we do carbon crediting and this and that, removal of Stover to a certain point is actually beneficial in Minnesota because it warms up the soil. It allows us to do more no-till. It allows some other stuff. We can't take all the Stover off, but taking certain percentages off on certain lands is actually a benefit, and it actually increases yield. And we have studies that it actually even shows the carbon buildup in the soil. So there is room to remove Stover and to go into the biomass area, but it needs to be managed properly by the right people and the right farmers. And there's been a lot of research done on that. In our area in southwest Minnesota, we've been working with the University of Minnesota Institute on the Environment, and we've done a three-year study on farming practices and how they relate to answer your question. That study has gone through many hands and has had peer review. It is going to be public released in about a week. I have it, but I'm not at liberty to release it. But these are things that are very important. I'm not on either side of this, but we're all in this together, and we want to do it right. We don't want to make a mistake.
All right. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For every gallon of biodiesel that you produce, how many gallons of water does it take going through the process of converting to this gallon of biofuel?
Mr. Colesford.
To clarify your question, and I appreciate it, you were talking about biodiesel. You're probably talking more about ethanol and some of these other things, too. If you use traditional corn to ethanol in a traditional facility, I can see in Minnesota, it takes about 3 gallons of water in that facility, and that's getting less all the time. So that's being watched very carefully. I am very harmonious with your question, because when we start doing these environmental things, there's three things that are really important: water and food and energy. And they come in that order: water, food, and energy. So we don't want to sacrifice some of the previous ones just for energy. But that is as a very, very good question. We've been very good in the ethanol industry to use very little water. We're using less all the time. One of the advantages Minnesota has, there's very little irrigation to grow our crops. So if you compare the amount of water it takes to make a gallon of ethanol here compared to a gallon of ethanol in western Kansas, where they have to irrigate it, or Nebraska, it's a huge amount of difference. Minnesota is in a very unique position to take advantage of some of this stuff. And I live in a part of Minnesota where water is a concern. We know that because of the Lewis and Clark and all the other issues surrounding that. So we don't treat that question lightly. We take it very seriously, but there are factors that we've been reducing it very minimally.
All right. Any other questions for Mr. Colesrud? I'm sorry, Representative Ugenius.
Just a follow-up on Representative Erickson's question. You said that we do very little irrigation. However, the request for irrigation permits in Minnesota is going up like this. So the expectation is that these numbers are old.
The question has been asked about the irrigation and little irrigation in Minnesota, and the question is basically irrigation permits are going up in the state of Minnesota because, right. And I think a lot of that is it's indirectly a result of some of probably the biofuels increasing the price of the commodities, but most of it is people. We're making money growing corn and beans, and they don't want to have the climate risk, and so they're applying for permits to irrigate. I don't know how to directly answer your question. They're going up, I think, because of the economics of agriculture and how that turned out to be profitable. Now that things have receded back, I think these permits are probably applied for, but a lot of them will not put them in. I'm just being speculative here, but a lot of them probably won't be put in because the economics don't lend well to be pumping water out of the ground to grow $4 corn. So,
if I could follow up?
Yeah, Representative Ugenius.
I think it might be helpful for this committee to hear about some of the permits that have been applied for, because while it might not seem economical, it is right now. You can take it off in your taxes, and so the permits are going up, and we do have conflict scenarios in this state, and I'm sure you're well aware of that. So the numbers we use for water use are in flux, if, to say the least.
Yeah, so that was my comment, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Anything else on that issue? If not, Representative Keel.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a comment about irrigation. I've got people putting in irrigation not because of the increase in income that they can make, because they're getting 6 bushels to the acre off of their soybeans. They absolutely need to be able to irrigate it in order to have any kind of a crop off of the land that they're now paying taxes and income and employing people. So just wanted to make sure we understood we aren't just irrigating because it's a lot of money. It's very costly to put it in.
All right. Thank you, Representative Keel.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Before we bring down the next testifier, I could have Mr. Sullivan. I apologize that
That's
we just
fine.
Rushed into the testimony right away.
That's okay. Any other questions for Mr. Caltrude? If not, then the next testifier is Larry Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Caltrude. But we're going to turn it over to Colby to go through the bill for us first in the DE2 form, I believe. Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, with the DE2 amendment, the bill would create 2 new grant programs and 1 new revolving loan program. The revolving loan program would be Section 1. It would the Department of Agriculture would administer all 3 programs. The first program does not receive funding in the bill, the revolving loan program, but it would be for capital equipment purchases by persons who participate in advanced biofuel, renewable chemical, or anaerobic digestion production facilities. And those terms are all defined in the bill, and I'll talk about the definitions for advanced biofuel and renewable chemical when I get to those sections. Section 2 is the advanced biofuel production incentive. As mentioned earlier, it would function very similar to the prior producer payment program for corn ethanol. Unlike how the ethanol program ended up, this program would have a statutory appropriation, so an open appropriation for the amount necessary to make the payments under this section, but that appropriation would be capped each fiscal year with the amendment at $15 million. So you see the definitions on page 2 that are important to understand who would receive the money, but the definition of advanced biofuels isn't in the amendment. There's a reference to statute. But advanced biofuels that would be eligible for the payments would be renewable fuel other than ethanol derived from cornstarch that has life cycle greenhouse gas emissions that are 50% less than baseline life cycle greenhouse gas emissions as determined by the US EPA. So that's who would be eligible. Producers of that material, advanced biofuels, would be eligible for the payments. The payment rates are set on lines 2.21 to 2.22 at a certain amount per million BTUs of energy produced, so energy equivalents of the amount of fuel that's produced. You see there's a higher payment for advanced biofuel from cellulosic biomass and a relatively lower payment for advanced biofuel from sugar or starch. There would be 10 years of payments on the rest of the advanced biofuel producer payment section. You see there are certain requirements for the production of the biomass that's used to produce grant-eligible fuels. The next page, page 3, is a lot of detail about how the program would be administered. It requires producers to apply quarterly. The department would award quarterly grants as they did for the ethanol producer payment program. They would also file an annual disclosure report with the Department of Agriculture. The contents of that disclosure report are on lines 3.18 to 3.33. And then the next, page 4 then, is the renewable chemical production incentive. It operates in a similar manner. Renewable chemicals would be those that have bio-based content, which is defined in existing Minnesota statutes as a chemical, polymer, monomer, or plastic that is not sold primarily for use as food, feed, or fuel, and that has a bio-based percentage of at least 51% as determined by an ASTM specification. So producers of renewable chemicals then would be eligible for grants calculated as a certain amount per pound of renewable chemical. That's on lines 4.26 through 4.28. There are different rates for different products again. And that and the rest of the this section also would have a statutory appropriation for the amount necessary to make the payments to all eligible producers up to a limit again of $15 million per fiscal year. So together the two programs would have appropriations a maximum of $30 million per fiscal year.
All right, thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Any questions on that? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To either the author or to Mr. Sullivan, when would these, if this becomes law, when would these payments be made available? When would they start?
Who wants to take that one? Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, the bill, if it was passed this session, would take effect on July 1st. But to be eligible for both the renewable chemical and the advanced biofuel production program, the facility can't be producing more than 950,000 MMBTUs before January 1st, 2015. That's the requirement for the advanced biofuel. There's a similar requirement, I believe, for chemical production. So as I read that, my interpretation is that in order for the department to verify that that standard has been met, the grants wouldn't begin until 2020. There may be another interpretation out there, though. But as I read it, I would say not until 2020.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Yeah, thanks for that clarification, because it seems past history that a lot of these cellulosic programs don't wrap up as fast as they are anticipated. So I was just concerned about if money's appropriated and sitting there, what would happen if none of these projects begin production before a certain date. And it would appear then we're looking at 2020 before these would be available.
Mr. Sullivan.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's correct, but I think may have misspoke. The plant would have to begin production at a specific location by June 30, 2020. So then if it had 10 years of payments, that would run through June 30th of 2030. The requirement, the limitation on how much it's producing when it becomes eligible actually starts on January 1st, 2015. So that's obviously much closer to today's date. So that's probably when the payments would begin then would be, that would be fiscal year 2015. Or next fiscal year, starting on July 1st of this year.
Okay. Anything else, Representative? No? All right. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is either to Chair Poppy or otherwise Mr. Sullivan. Well, first of all, thank you for bringing this forward, this bill forward. Is there a provision in there that if a company, a recipient of these payments, if they close to where they're no longer eligible for those payments, so we had a similar experience with the ethanol industry. So is there some language that would prohibit that from happening again?
Representative
yes.
Poppy.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. On 5.23, 5.24, any producer that ceases production for any reason is ineligible to receive payments under the program until they begin producing again.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Hamilton.
And Mr. Chair, also, is there language in here? I'm just thinking ahead here, you know, with Governor Plenty, and I believe it was Chair Junkey and Chair Otremba, where we set up the AGRA account and we captured the producer payments when they're done, the ethanol payments, where in the event this program is successful, we get it funded, and comes to an end, can we automatically capture these payments again and keep them in agriculture? Do we have any language like that? Either Mr. Sullivan or Chair Poppy.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is not in the bill currently to do that.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hamilton.
Yeah, let's work on an amendment or something to do that, because I think that's extremely important looking forward as well. The last question I have is, I think on the original bill we had a provision in there about biomass thermal production. Was that taken out of the DE amendment?
Yes.
Representative Poppy.
And the reason?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
I think there was some difficulty with that language for some people.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. All right. Representative Wiginius.
Thank you. As we're going through the bill on lines 2.24 and 4.29, there is a requirement for all the forestry-derived biomass to meet certain standards that were developed for sustainability. But we don't have that same kind of standard for agriculture biomass. So as the testifiers are going through, I would just like some comments on that.
Okay. All right. All right. Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Sullivan on the bill? If not, we will go to the next testifier, Mr. Larry Johnson. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Just for clarification again, you know, the comment about not being eligible to receive the payments, in the original bill, we also had a provision in there about paying back payments. I don't know, Mr. Sullivan, if you could speak to that, or Chair Poppy. On the original bill, I think it was line 5.33 on the original. I was just wondering if... Okay. You know, we need that in there, or should we have that in there?
Okay. Just Mr. Sullivan, if you would address that, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, that's correct. The bill as introduced had language in both programs that said if an eligible person becomes ineligible 5 years after they receive their last payment, they would have to return all payments received to the Department of Agriculture. That language is not in the DE2 amendment.
And your question is, should we put that back in? Is that what you asked, Mr. Representative Hamilton?
Mr. Chair, I was just raising the point and for the discussion if that needs to be in there or not. Okay. And the logic behind it.
All right. Thank you. All right. We will move on to the next testifier, Mr. Larry Johnson. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Larry Johnson. I spent 25 years farming in Carver County, Minnesota, and the last 28 years working as a consultant to the ethanol industry in a variety of capacities. In fact, in the early days of the 80s and early 90s, I spent 10 consecutive contracts with the Department of Agriculture doing ethanol promotion and development. Prior to that, I was very much involved with the creating and developing the first ethanol producer payment, upon which this is somewhat based on. The biochemicals industry today and the cellulosic ethanol today are just on the verge of, I think, really exploding and replacing a lot more petroleum than we have been. I think it's much the same as the ethanol industry was back in 1988 when we passed the first producer payment. In fact, I'll give you just a little bit of a history on that. In 1986, when we talk about funding, it always seems to be difficult funding time, but that wasn't very, very contentious session, for those of you who may remember that. This was passed through the support of Speaker Dave Jennings at the time, Tax Chairman Doug Johnson, and the Governor. There was not a lot of debate on that. It kind of snuck through. In fact, I was kind of proud of it because there was no professional lobbyists working on it at the time, just a bunch of farmers. And at the end of that session, the Minneapolis Tribune had, on the front page, it said, this session in 1986 had two increases in funding. One was the ethanol producer payment, and the other one was the National Guard down to labor problems down in Austin. So it did start out, and I think it paid great dividends for the ethanol industry and agriculture in Minnesota. The when that started, we had a 4 cent producer payment. I'm sorry, a 4 cent tax exemption in Minnesota that was supposed to create an industry. That was a tax exemption, cost money from the highway fund, and in fact, all the money went to ADM because they were just bringing the money in over the border. There was an effort made to make it only in-state, but that turned out to be not constitutional. And so we changed it back then from a 4 cent tax exemption to a 2 cent exemption and took that saving and put it into the ethanol producer payment, which was a $10 million fund to begin with. So one of the things that caused that to happen, and we had no ethanol production in Minnesota at that time, but the requirements of these people that promoted it and were going to pass it said they needed a letter that we would actually get something built. Minnesota Corn Processors at that time was a cooperative, and they sent the letter up that they were going to build a 10 million gallon plant. add that onto their wet milling sugar plant, their syrup plant. As soon as it was passed, they did, and they had it operating by 1987. Other farmer groups then decided this was going to be a viable investment, and so they worked hard to get it done, and finally we got the St. Paul Bank of Cooperatives to agree to finance 50% of these plants, providing farmers raise the other equity. And as a result of that, as you all know, now we've got 21 ethanol plants in Minnesota. So it was a difficult time at that time for a product that really wasn't known. We weren't sure of the technology. We weren't sure of the marketplace. Bringing up to date now, I have continued to work in the ethanol industry. The last 5 years, I've done a lot of work for Invicon. Invicon is a cellulosic ethanol technology company out of Denmark. I have created for them the business plan of everything from the field to the ethanol plant of harvesting 360,000 tons of corn stover off the field, including all of the issues regarding logistics, removal, agricultural fertility, and moisture and storage. Many issues. It's a very complicated process. But today we have got three companies that finally are getting into the ethanol, cellulosic ethanol business: Poet in Iowa, DuPont in Iowa, and Avangoa in Kansas City. In Kansas, they're all building ethanol plants that are costing in excess of $250 million investment. None of them are getting financed from outside because they're the first of a kind. They're all self-financed, which we need some assistance from the state and the technology that they're going to bring on, that this is now a viable industry. So we'll have three commercial plants doing between 20 and 30 million gallons per year of ethanol from biomass, mostly corn stover, by the end of the year. So with that, I'd be glad to take any questions. Oh, one comment about irrigation. If we're looking at corn stover or some of the energy dedicated crops, they will take less water than current corn crops or corn or soybeans do right now. So from the irrigation issue, I think cellulosic ethanol should be an advantage from a water use standpoint.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any questions? No? If not, well, thank you very much for your testimony, and let us bring up the next one, Dr. Nicholas Jordan. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Jordan. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Nick Jordan. I'm a faculty member in the Agronomy and Plant Genetics Department at the University of Minnesota. And I'd like to present three perspectives on the bill that's coming along. I've been involved in agricultural science for, I guess, 33 years as a graduate student and as a faculty member, and my opinion is that the opportunity to produce biomass in a sustainable fashion is the best opportunity to move the needle on both production and conservation, resource conservation, that has come along certainly in my career. I think there's an outstanding opportunity to do both of those things. And so I'd like to speak to three particular points about really taking that opportunity. The first of these is I'd like to underscore the point that was made by David Colesrud about the sustainability of the harvest of corn stover. We know pretty well how to do that in a sustainable way, and what it requires is the combination of conservation tillage. It requires collecting stover from highly productive soils, and it in most places is very much aided by the production of cover crops that grow over winter and which can replace a lot of the fertility and organic matter in the soil that would otherwise come from the stover. So done properly, there's the potential to produce a large volume of corn stover from the upper Midwest in a highly sustainable fashion. The second point that I'd like to put on the table is that there are some very interesting technologies that really allow us to make use of the potential of biomass agriculture to expand both production and conservation. So to really realize the conservation benefits, what we need to do is to do something that the previous speaker alluded to, and that is to grow a range of different biomass crops that have that are adapted to different circumstances, that are more or less water efficient, that are more or less able to provide wildlife habitat, that are more or less dependent on nutrient inputs, and that are more or less able to tolerate various stresses. And the opportunity to put that diversity of biomass crops out onto our Minnesota farmed landscapes is a great opportunity to improve resource conservation. For example, we can grow biomass crops that can collect runoff water and can collect the nutrients in that runoff water, and therefore take advantage of resources that would otherwise be wasted. We can grow biomass crops that are excellent wildlife habitat and harvest them in ways that preserves the quality of that habitat. So there's a terrific opportunity to preserve, to increase conservation and production, but we need some way for farmers and landowners to actually make some money in the process. And the new technologies that I mentioned are all about adding value to what we call lignocellulosic biomass, so corn stover or mature warm season perennial grasses are an example. There are technologies emerging, and there are three at this point that are promising, one of which AFEX is detailed in the handout that I think you might have. And each of these adds value to biomass by relatively simple chemical treatments that greatly increase the digestibility of the cellulose in that biomass. And furthermore, they make that biomass available not only for biorefining, but they also make it available as a high-quality animal feed. And this provides farmers and landowners two different marketing options, which is a much better economic place to be than just having one marketing option. So that's the second point I'd like to make, these emerging technologies that let us get this diversity out in the landscape. Then the final thing I'd like to kind of put on the table here is the idea that to take advantage of this opportunity to expand both production and conservation, we need to be careful to kind of do this right. And so large-scale monocultures of perennial biomass crops are going to cause big problems, just like large-scale monocultures of our annual crops can cause some problems. So we need to figure out how it is that we expand this biomass agriculture in a way that produces as much conservation and as much production value, and also as much benefit for rural communities in terms of things like new recreational opportunities and other kinds of spin-off economic benefits. And the final page of the handout talks about something that we're working with partners at Land-Grant universities in Wisconsin and Iowa as well, which we call biomass land labs. And these are simply centers where we can bring together the resources and ingenuity of the many folks that have an interest in trying to expand this biomass agriculture and do it in the right way. And we can figure out how to produce biomass from agricultural lands sustainably. Representative Wagenius mentioned the importance of those sustainability standards for agricultural biomass, and we fully agree. So we're actively working on figuring those standards out. We can figure out how to develop supply chains and value chains that fit well in rural communities, and we can figure out how to expand this biomass agriculture in a way that provides as much opportunity for rural communities and much benefit for rural communities as we can. So thank you for your attention and the opportunity to testify, and I would be happy to respond to any questions.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Jordan. Any questions? Yes. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just like your thoughts on the original bill had a line that was removed in the DE amendment, and I just want your reaction to it, is that agriculturally derived cellulosic biomass must be produced in a way that is consistent with recommendations from the United States Department of Agriculture Natural Resources Conservation Service. And I don't know about those recommendations. I don't know if you do. I guess my first question is, are you aware of those? Do you know those recommendations? Or
I Dr. Jordan. Know them in broad brush terms. Okay. Yes, I do.
would there be value in assuring those standards were met in this, or do you have any thoughts on that,
Dr. Jordan?
Thank you. My own view is that it is better to proceed in a more local kind of way and try to figure out what standards would really make sense for the North Central region and Minnesota in particular, rather than starting with a set of fixed standards that are more blanket.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then you talk about we need to figure out how to do this well, basically. And that's what I... do you think that we, for instance, my entire life I've heard, well, my entire adult life almost, it feels like I've heard about switchgrass is the future. And yet I never see any switchgrass except in the wild at Minneopa State Park. And so I don't see any movement on that. Do you think that we have a lot of knowledge about the alternatives, other sorts of agricultural biomass that could be used beyond corn stover, which is, I think, being established in Iowa? Do we have a well-developed body of knowledge on some other alternatives?
Dr. Jordan.
I think the answer is yes. I would again point to these new technologies that allow us to produce high-value biomass commodities from a really wide range of feedstocks, and so that we don't have to figure out feedstock by feedstock all of the kind of technology aspects of it. So the AFEX technology that's on the handout that I believe you have is something that can be used with a really wide range of feedstocks, and the process is really quite generic. So what we've really faced with those is that there have been marketing and technology barriers. The cellulosic ethanol based on fermentation has required a set of enzymes that were very specific to particular feedstocks, and that has been a big barrier. But these emerging technologies don't require that. They're more flexible. So my answer is yes. I think we're ready to move on those.
All right. Thank you. All right. Any other questions for Dr. Jordan? If not, thank you very much for your testimony, and we'll ask the next testifier, Valerie Jarek, to come down, please. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for coming. And please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Valerie Jarek, and I have been before this committee so many times. I am the lobbyist for the Minnesota Corn Growers and for the Minnesota Ethanol Producers Association. But today I'm here testifying on behalf of POET Energies out of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and that's a plant you keep hearing about that's at Emmitsburg, Iowa. We're handing out a brochure that they put together to show you where that plant is at right now. Brandon had asked POET to give you some background on that. This is kind of the going to be the godfather or grandfather of the cellulosic industry here, because this plant is now in construction and will be starting to produce ethanol up to 25 million gallons late June or late summer, early fall. And just to take a quick look at the brochure, and we'll get one for you. You can see what POET is, but the first photo, the landscape, that's the rendition of what the plant will look like when it's completed. And as you can see, they're under construction now. Information that you see on the sheet that has the writing on it, that there's a plentiful supply of corn stover, and that's what they're harvesting. They have been purchasing corn stover now for the last 3 years and been stockpiling, getting ready for the production. The Project Liberty in Emmitsburg's needs can be met with one-third of the corn acres in a 30 to 40 mile radius. So to make it economical, you can't haul that too far, but So it's something to think about as we go forward and work on this language in this bill. They purchase corn from over 600 farmers in that area, and so many of those farmers, because Emmitsburg is so close to Minnesota, much of that corn stover is being purchased from our own Minnesota farmers, putting money into this economy here. And it can be harvested with a standard combine and baler. And they were so nice as to give you a photograph of what corn stover looks like. So if you haven't ever seen a corn cob, here's one for you. You can see the bales that have been piling up. They've been stockpiling down there for the last couple of years. And then there's just pictures of the construction, so you can see what phases are in at this point. And I don't know why we have so many of those, but we do, and that's their money they're spending. And then if you look at the next sheet, the economics of it, a single plant is a $200 million investment, 45 full-time jobs, and hundreds of construction jobs. It brings over $2 million into the community every year before you do the add-ons, and over $20 million for biomass acquisition a year. So that's $20 million that's being picked up off the field that currently is being lost. It provides energy security. Over 1 million barrels of imported oil a year is replaced by one single plant. And that is $50 million of our money that's going into foreign economies and jobs that can stay in Minnesota and in the United States. Cellulosic ethanol has to be at least 60% better than gasoline to meet the greenhouse gas standards. A single plant will reduce over 210 tons of CO2, which is extremely important. We're currently looking at several studies on the health impacts of CO2 and the aromatics issue. So it's important that we continue to grow this industry and ethanol and other biofuels. Anything that will help that problem is a big plus for this, for our people and for the health economy. 25% of the stover is taken from the field, and that's all they're doing now. The best management practices that have been developed through, as Mr. Calzrud alluded to, the University of Minnesota and the Department of Agriculture helped to develop the standard for how much corn stover can be removed, and that's going to vary from area to area. There's a map of the ethanol plants that are in Minnesota now, producing 1.1 billion gallons. And one of the final pages asks, what if 10 of Minnesota's 21 corn ethanol plants were converted to cellulosic or added cellulosic ethanol? Liberty is going to have 40 jobs in Minnesota. We could have 10 times that. 180 indirect jobs from the Liberty plant, over 200 construction jobs, a $250 million investment in Emmitsburg, and the biomass purchases are about $20 million annually just for that one facility. And like I said, they'll be producing this summertime, late summer. And we wanted to let you know how important it is and what this bill could help do. We have some concerns with the bill yet. There's some things that we want to continue to work with all the stakeholders on. And hopefully we'll have it all put together and right soon, and everyone will be very happy with it. And
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions for Ms. Jarrett? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jarrett, there's some concern among ethanol people about the EPA's RFS standard hitting the blend wall and such.
Correct.
Now, could you clarify ethanol produced in this new cellulosic method? That's in a different category, correct? So it wouldn't be competing as such in terms of the RFS with corn-based ethanol.
That's
correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's my understanding, because the standards are different. It meets different federal standards.
Okay. Other questions? No? All right. Thank you very much. And the last testifier here on the list, Ryan Buck. You here? Welcome to the committee, Mr. Buck, and please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Ryan Buck. I'm a corn farmer from Goodhue, Minnesota, and I also currently serve as the Minnesota Corn Growers President. We represent over 7,000 corn growing members in our state. Minnesota Corn supports House File 2456, which would establish a production incentive program for advanced biofuels and renewable chemicals, similar to the ethanol payment program that was established back in the 1980s. While I was too small to be involved in farming back then, I can speak to it now, what it has done for the rural economy, corn farmers, and especially the next generation of corn farmers, as such as myself. We are tremendously proud as farmers of what we have helped build, and grateful to the policy leaders who shared our vision. It has not always been an easy road, and like every business, the industry has had its ups and downs. However, the ethanol industry itself is a giant success story for a once struggling rural economy. Lenders needed the security to invest in these small farmer-owned ethanol plants, and a new technology and the producer payment program provided that. It worked. After a certain period of time, plants could survive without the program, and the initial incentive payment were no longer necessary. Now the ethanol industry contributes over $5 billion to the state's economy, provides over 12,000 jobs, For myself, most of the corn that we grow goes to our local ethanol plant, which is in Claremont, Minnesota. We also own shares in that. Now that the producer payment program for ethanol plants has ended, I would challenge us to look to the next opportunity. This proposal could help make us competitive in advancing another new industry, add thousands of jobs to the economy, and once again provide new opportunities for farmers. I encourage you to support this bill, and thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Buck. Any questions? No? Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are there any others from the audience that would like to testify? Oh, okay. Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have an amendment that I'd like to submit for this bill. I believe it should be in the packets. And I don't know how to handle this, but there is a typo on 1.10. I believe it should read towards the end, an organization instead of a organization. I hope that can be just accepted as.
Yeah, that should be no problem.
Can we do that? Okay, good.
Okay,
so right. I'd like to move the amendment. Is that how I handle that?
Yep, that's fine. Representative Johnson moves the, I'm looking for a number on the amendment. My copy doesn't have one.
Mine doesn't either.
Make one up. All right, let's do amendment number 39 then.
39?
All right. So explain what your amendment does, please.
Okay. I think there's a lot of opportunity with cellulosic biofuels. I really do. And we heard in the testimony today that the potential for rural Minnesota is great, and the potential to meet the fuel needs of the country is tremendous as well. But I also think there's an opportunity for us to figure out how to take advantage of other sources of biomass that can be used to create the fuel other than corn stover or the trees or the sugar beets. I see those are all appropriate sources for the fuel, but it gets back to my question about the switchgrass. And I've heard about switchgrass all my life, yet never seen it. And I don't believe any of the plants are currently going there. So what this amendment does is ask the Commissioner of Agriculture to convene a task force to identify those opportunities to generate biomass for advanced biofuel and renewable chemical production from agricultural perennials and cover crops. I know there's increasing interest in cover crops, but there's not a lot of money in cover crops. And I think that there's really an opportunity here to create a market that will add to the sustainability of this industry, that can enhance the environment. And I think why we know that we can biologically we know some of those solutions, but I don't think we know much about the market, and my evidence is that there hasn't been a market created. So I would be asking this task force, and you can see in Section B, who would be on that task force, to seek to inform the state about what is their potential to develop this market. So that's what the amendment's about.
All right. We actually now have an official number. It is the A2 amendment, so A2, I guess we'll scratch that.
39 is a good number.
I like 39 better, but it's the A2 amendment officially, so that is your motion is to adopt the A2 amendment. Any questions on that? Representative Crenshaw.
Thank you, Chair. Chair Faust, just a question. I know as I'm reading through this, I know that I noticed that we have the word must. 1.4, we've also got it in 1.15, and it might be a couple of. It almost seems to me, because it's a new thing and just being introduced, that it may be a better approach would be to put may in, especially since I don't know if you know of a way to pay for this yet, and just something to consider as we put this together.
Thank you, Representative Crenshaw, and maybe Representative Poppy has some comments on that as well, what this may do to her bill.
We'll let Representative Johnson just respond to that first.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I guess the word I usually see is shall. I think we shall. I think the time is now. And I think I spoke with a couple of representatives from the Department of Agriculture this morning, and they thought they can do this. So they saw this as something that they can do.
Okay. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And going on that line of questioning, I was wondering if there's a fiscal note that's attached to this. I understand it's a policy committee, but with that said, where does this travel? Where's this bill going?
This would be going to the Committee on Environmental Natural Resources and Agriculture Finance is where it will go next.
So then, Mr. Chair, I was wondering if, and I did talk with Representative Johnson on a few issues and understand you know, what some of his thoughts are here, but I was wondering if, one, we have someone from the Department of Agriculture who could speak to this, see if there's support there as well, and then some of the groups that are being asked to participate on that, just so that we're fully informed on this, and if not, if there's a possibility to work with the author between this and the next stop, I think that's a possibility as well.
I think that might be the better possibility since we're out of time. It also, this amendment would make it, this bill would have to stop at the government operations because it's setting up a task force. So there would, so I guess that's it. So let me go back to Representative Poppy to get her opinion on this and see what she would like to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have also spoken with Representative Johnson, and I understand the sincerity behind it. He really does believe that this is a movement that we need to be pursuing. I do know that the coalition is trying to be a coalition. They're trying to meet the needs of each other's concerns, and there is some concern about this as it's presented, but I do believe that the coalition has been a strong and ardent coalition for a long time now, and they continue to look at these issues and really work through them. So, you know, frankly, if it were on the bill, I think the coalition would deal with that and say, you know, we can do this much, we can't do this much. If it's not on the bill, I think they would probably do likewise. So I appreciate that he's bringing it forward and wants to see this be a part of that discussion.
Okay. Yeah, so if you want to work on it between now and the next committee stop, you would need to withdraw it. Otherwise, we'll vote on it and see what happens. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Vigenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to suggest an amendment to your amendment, if I could, and I... Dr. Jordan, when he talked about the opportunity for sustainability, his number third point was we have to make sure to be careful to do things right, which I think folks agree with. And he said, don't do large-scale monocultures. Well, when I look at the last switchgrass, Indian grass, and big blue stem, that is large-scale monoculture. So I would think that maybe if we just took out Section D, we would not stumble into that large-scale monoculture issue.
All right. We'll ask but Representative...
I will only ask the author. I'm not going to propose it as an amendment, but we have been cautioned, and I think I don't want to read into his testimony, but I think the large-scale doing monoculture means that we will then go back to using heavy-duty inputs, both on the fertilizer and the pesticide side.
Very good. All right. Thank you, Representative Wagenius. All right. I guess Representative Kreshaw.
And thank you, Chair Faust. And just to the author of the amendment, things are moving pretty fast around here, and I would hate to do anything that would slow this bill down and all the work that's in there. I absolutely understand the intent. I don't understand the content, to be honest. This is coming fast, and I would have to research it. I, in all honesty, could not support this amendment. And I would just think that we should do our due diligence and make sure we're doing this right so the unintended consequences that may crop up don't crop up.
All right. Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Okay, Mr. Chair. I can see there's a problem here. I would really think I think it's pretty straightforward, to be honest with you. I think a study such as this is very appropriate, very timely. I'm not an obstructionist by any means, but I do put forth the amendment, and this was put forth very genuinely. I think this should be done. I don't sit on the next committee. So I'm just going to, I'm willing to move along, but I do believe that a number of people sitting here in this room today do sit in the next committee, and I'll make their request that at the next stop on this bill, that this concept, I think it's pretty clear what I'm trying to do here, is addressed in a serious way. I think there's an opportunity here in Minnesota. Monocultures, we heard from Dr. Jordan, are a challenge, and this is an opportunity to really diversify the landscape a little bit and to provide some cover crops and to provide some significant environmental cover. So I'll withdraw the amendment at this time with the understanding that this topic will be addressed in the next committee in my absence.
Thank you very much, Mr. Representative Johnson, and I will remind you that anyone can attend those committee hearings. So, with that, Representative Poppy, do you have a last word before we vote on your bill?
Thank you. I do want to see this move forward, and I appreciate the support and the conversations. I think we do need to continue having dialogue, and the coalition is really a part of that. They need to have that dialogue and amongst themselves, and there is give and take. So I appreciate that you've brought it forward to have us food for thought. So thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative Poppy renews her motion to move House File 2456 as amended to the Committee on Environmental, Natural Resources, and Agricultural Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And Representative Patty Fritz, I believe that you're off the hook today.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, but I did bring award-winning blue cheese and its counterpart, two award-winning cheeses from my district, and they're over there, and I don't want them to go to waste, so I want the members to all help themselves. They're all packaged in nice little plastic baggies, so there's no cross-contamination. It's all very healthy, and it's excellent cheese, so please take one from each bag and some crackers.
All right. Well,
so I don't have to take it home.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much, and we will look forward to your legislative district profile next time.
Yeah.
And with that, meeting adjourned.